Michael Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about
page 52 letters, the editor's pick. War is a fairly recent part of human history. Kenneth Payne offers an important and illuminating discussion of the problem of artificial intelligence presents in the military sphere. He opens by stating, archaeological and ethnographical evidence suggests that warfare among our hunter-gatherers ancestors was common. The claim has been promulgated by some high-profile writers recently, but not everyone agrees. For example, in the 2013 War, Peace and Human Nature, The Convergence of Evolutionary and Cultural Views, a review of the issue by archaeologists, anthropologists, evolutionary biologists, primatologists, neuroscientists, physiologists and social scientists drew the opposite conclusion. They said archaeological evidence reveal war is a relatively recent phenomenon emerging from the Neolithic period onwards. We have much to learn about what drives societies to fight, but the idea that war is inherent to human nature relies more on cherry-picking the data support cultural bias than any objective view of evidence. Sense of Self in Science, Shakespeare and Trout, by Steve Brewer, a letter from St. Ives, Cornwall, UK. Sophia Delevingne describes self-awareness as an illusion, and on your cover, you call it a delusion. What wasn't discussed was the power to turn the whole world as we view it into illusions by the process of informing abstract concepts and ideas about it. By developing, interconnecting these abstractions, we have produced various sciences. Through them, we have achieved enormous power over ourselves and our natural worlds. Self-awareness may yield this great power, but it also results in a broader illusion held by many that this world of abstraction is more real than the natural one. This world of concepts, individuals have become just another concept, and so dehumanized. Recognizing this is as the most dangerous delusion may help defend our humanity. Beautiful set of thoughts, but people can't really, a delusion of delusions. Illusions is beautiful. By Kim Brody, Staten Island, New York. My self-awareness thoroughly enjoyed Delevingne's article. Her conclusion, however, seems regulated human self-awareness to be a byproduct of the humming of our neural engine, not essentially different from, for instance, the 3D echolocation modelling that goes on in a bat's brain. And, if self-awareness doesn't require a higher order of consciousness but a running simulation in our brains, consciousness may not necessarily have a function. This line of thinking reminds me of William James's 1890 Principles of Psychology, in which he argues that we are fully understood. If we fully understood Shakespeare's nervous system, we could account for every word and alteration of the manuscript to Hamlet without having to acknowledge the existence of thoughts of Shakespeare's mind. Having reduced the arguments to absurdity, James moves on to considered consciousness. Another, Daniel Hackett, London, UK. Delevingne suggests self-awareness is an extension of the challenge of dealing with the minds of others, prey, competitors, and members of your social group. Territoriality should not be underestimated as an example of such a challenge. If you put two trout into a small tank, they would skirmish. The loser will change to a dark colour and sulk at the bottom. It knows it has been beaten and does not try it on until the top trout goes away. It may not, that's interesting. It may not have a demonstrable "this is me" mode, but surely this is more where individualization starts. This kind of awareness of one's situation. Oh, good on you, Guy Cox. He's a great writer. I know Guy Cox. I hope he is. Jeffrey Hart suggests that stratum of the plasteogramic might geologically delineate the Atropine, or I prefer to call it the Pleistocene epoch. Plastic persists long enough to cause havoc in our oceans, but will not withstand the geological heat and pressures of geological timescales. Plus, it's the most commonly carbon and hydrogen, and ultimately could be converted to coal and oil. Maybe a new civilization, millions of years hence, will mine these stars, the whole cycle over again. Defining moment of, I think that's not really necessary, that's a nice thought, but it's not necessarily true. Defining moment for global scale renewables. From Paul Van Lodswell, Devon, UK. Michael Lepage discussed the potential of very large-scale desert solar wind farms to increase the local rainfall and hence vegetation. And the UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres declared on the 10th of September that we are at the defining moment for avoiding runaway climate change. It seems we have a critical need and opportunity for a global project, led perhaps by the UN and the World Bank, to make global scale investment in a very, very large scale desert-based solar and wind farms. I'm sure there are many pensions and other investment funds looking for this securely and responsibly, but we're at present of divesting from oil, gas and other destructive pollution sectors. Perhaps this will tempt them. Such schemes would be bigger than any energy projects yet undertaken. Many countries would have to be involved in the science and engineering, and the projects must balance the interests of communities and contractors, manufacturers, investors, governments, and other potential beneficiaries or losers, I'd say. What is the true impact of electric cars? Alice Klein reports hydrogen-powered cars competing with electric cars on environmental grounds, questions if either are green. Say an electric car's batteries are charged with electricity from a gas-fired power station with a carbon footprint of 400 grams per kilowatt hour. Say losses in transmission are 14% and causes, and the car uses 0.5 watts per kilometer. The carbon dioxide emission is about 70 grams per kilometer. Some petrol-powered carbon cars have emissions at this level. If coal is used instead of gas, the electric car emits more CO2. The figures for hydrogen cars are similar unless the hydrogen is made only using renewable electricity. This will remain true until existing electricity demand has been satisfied by low carbon generation, as there is some spare capacity. When do we think this is going to happen? Never, unless we focus on the real issues, more solar panels, more wind, and maybe nuclear power, I'd say. At present, the UK government gets around $34 billion in fuel duty from vehicle tax on road transportation. The incentive to move to electric includes little or no vehicle tax on them and recharging at home bearing a 5% domestic tax, a lot less than the tax rate levied on petrol and diesel. A lot of electric vehicles go on the road and government stands to lose a considerable amount of tax. So, what are the plans for the later increasing revenue from electric vehicles to bring the future cost of electric motoring in line with the present cost of petrol diesel, where the greatest part of the cost is fuel tax? The cost of on-street recharging could include electric fuel tax. Will charging at home require a separate smart metering to levy in e-fuel charging, including tax? Acoustic levitation might get water from desert air, that's an interesting thing, by Yorks Volks, Manforce Country, Durham, UK. Ivan Ye reports on using sound pressure to create a bubble in levitating droplets. 5 years ago, Jacob Aron described a similar levitation using sound creating a standing wave in which gravitational and acoustic waves cancel. Levitated objects could be removed along a line with the forces cancelled out and mixed by varying the strength of the sound waves. Maybe this could become more than a clever trick. Around the third Earth's land area is desert. In many places, the only fresh water is collected by adapted plants and the morning mists blow in the sea. There have been many suggestions over the years how to trap soils of fresh water for human use. Might it be possible to set up a high-frequency acoustic standing wave between an emitter and reflector to move the water droplets along the fold downwards collect to the base of the device? I would say not. Isn't that amazing? Okay. We have created conditions for superbugs. I read with interest Michael Lepage's account of the science waging war attrition with evolution. We seem to forget that survival depends on Mother Nature's ability to bounce back after terrible things we keep doing to her. Unless we've killed the soil biome with the chemicals, we'll have no other options but to farm chemically. We are removing the natural balance, and that's why we have to continually compensate with yet more chemicals. Pharmaceuticals and agrochemical companies stand to gain, destroy the natural fertility of the soil, and we are dependent on artificial fertilizers, the manufacture and use of which worsens other problems that of greenhouse gas emissions. We've created the conditions for superbugs, both insects and bacterial, in monocultures, in our guts and in the soil, in the fields, in the forests and the hospitals, intensive farming, even the oceans, that create the conditions where things we fear most can thrive conveniently. These conditions also require us to spend more and more on chemical intervention, both mechanically and medically and agriculturally. Fuming on planes, trains, and maybe latrines. Lara Williams' comment on vaping on public transport reminded me of conversations back when smoking was allowed on buses, trains, and aeroplanes. The person sitting next to you might ask, "Do you mind if I smoke?" and perhaps add, "Just a bad habit, I can't shake it." The appropriate reply was, "No, not at all. Do you mind if I fart? It's just a habit, I can't seem to shake it." So that's a lovely story. Last word. The aftermath of a horrendous Grenfell Tower disaster in London last year, I'd like to know why rescuing trapped individuals appears beyond our present capabilities. Why we can't construct ladders that will reach people trapped in tall buildings? Why we can't? Why can't all towers have nets that are deployed around the base to catch those willing to jump? Especially if I combine with occupants being provided with inflatable suits to cushion their falls. Why can't helicopters be deployed to rescue from windows and balconies? Why aren't all occupants in high-rise apartments given the chance to escape by sliding down wires or slides? Why are such suggestions considered outlandish? The reason most are considered outlandish is that few such ideas could work. Nets around towers would be vandal-prone and need a lot of maintenance to ensure they were ready for the emergency. Unscathed people falling more than a few metres into nets could break their necks, inflatable clothing or not. Nor can jumpers rapidly vacate a net before hundreds of people would evacuate. Many would die landing on each other. Fire escapes are more useful. Forget helicopters unless an undamaged accessible helipad is on the building. But it would take many helicopters to evacuate a large building. Some ideas might be worth developing. Suitable fire escape parachutes could ease the victims down cables. Individual fire escape reels could be designed to unwind at a controlled speed to lower occupants to the ground, or something could be based on a zip line. Fire escape slides on or ladders deployable externally from the top of a building might work, but deploying them in emergencies would be a challenge. Rationally designed lifts are probably the best escape route, while the building remains intact, but current design standards means most lifts are not useful in emergencies. I prefer the idea of those who are trapped jumping into inflatable funnels that rise a few hundred metres deployed and steered from rescue vehicles. Controlled airfoils and baffles into the funnel would avoid dangerous speeds and rescued subjects could be extracted at the bottom. The longer the ladder is, the stronger the heavier it needs to be. This would make ladders capable of high-ride rescues hard to manoeuvre in narrow city streets. Limited access to the area in the base of Grenfell Tower made it much harder for the London Fire Brigade to set up normal appliances. As for nets, in order to slow someone's descent gently enough to avoid fatal injuries, they would need to be suspended high off the ground. This would make it tricky to set them up quickly. They would also potentially get in the way of firefighters. Inflatable suits would need to be very bulky to make a difference and would slow down people trying to escape. Flying helicopters next to buildings is dangerous at the best of times, especially if the building is on fire and debris are falling. Zip wires have some merit, but are slow, heavy and need training to set up, not to mention suitable anchor points. Along with size, they have their uses in situations where the risk of fire is relatively high. Boeing has them at space launch sites, for instance. I suspect that most such ideas are thought outlandish for tower blocks because the strategy of containing a fire within a single flat is cheaper, easier, and usually very effective. There are better solutions than nets and wires and so on. By all means, use cladding to make buildings look prettier, but use non-inflatable materials. Design a building to resist fire, avoiding cavities through which it can spread. Install sprinklers and pressurize the air and stair lift shafts to keep smoke at bay. And hence, provide a safe exit path where temperatures, visibility, and electricity is kept within safe limits, long enough for people to escape. You can include a bridge to an adjacent tall building. Allow for safe refuges to give time for fire brigade to rescue the occupants, such as installing entrance doors to flats that are best at least resist fire for 15 minutes. And finally, towers should have a means of warning the occupants of the emergency evacuation. Next, that was by Terence Hollingworth of Ballignac, France. During my 32 years in fire and rescue service, I have been to numerous fires and flats, and fires that have never spread beyond the flat where it started. This is how buildings must be designed. However, for policy advising residents in other flats to stay put during the fire, to be reliable, design and maintenance of the fire-resisting components and fire doors is vital. As for outlandish ideas, in the Victorian period, there was numerous patents for self-rescue devices to use in a building fire. One I recall was a cord concealed in a gentleman's belt, which could be used to escape down the outside of a building. Another podcast, another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.